Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Coffee and Open Source. I'm excited for my guests today. We're going to talk about origin stories, open source, and all sorts of great tech topics as well. I'd like to welcome my guest. My guest today is Suze Hinton. Suze, do you want to say hello? Introduce yourself.
Sure. Hi, thank you so much for having me. My name is Suze Hinton, as Isaac just introduced me, and pretty excited to be on this chat. I have not been on a casual podcast chat in a while. But yeah, I'm a senior software developer. I currently work at Stripe, and I work on developer tools. So if you ever used any of Stripe's SDKs or our awesome command line tool, I work on those kinds of things. And then we have a bunch of other stuff that we work on outside of that too. But yeah, that's pretty much me.
Awesome. Well, I really want to get into the Stripe stuff because I do think there's some, I've been following kind of the Stripe developer ecosystem for a bit, and I'd love to chat with you more about that. So, but I'd like to get started with, you know, like I said in the intro, like origin stories, right? So I think one of the things that's always very interesting to find out is how people were introduced to tech, right? So do you remember a point in time, like maybe when you were younger, maybe you were in school, maybe even in university, where you came across tech and you're like, this is it. This is the thing that I need to spend the rest of my life trying to figure out.
Yeah, it's kind of embarrassing because if you go right back to the absolute very beginning, I was watching TV with my family and, you know, like there are certain computer related advertisements that you see on TV and they have bright colors and music and dancing, especially in my generation. And the actual advertisement was just for a printer. It was for the Canon BubbleJet printer. And I think BubbleJet just captured my imagination as a kid. I was like, that sounds cool. And they were just showing, you know, printing out art. And I just loved making art at the time. And, you know, I turned to my dad and I was like, I want one of them. And he sort of chuckled and said, well, you need a computer. And I was like, I don't even understand what that means, that you need a computer to have this printer. I see art coming out of it and I would like it. And so, you know, we didn't really end up getting that printer, obviously, because we didn't have a computer.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I think shortly after that, because, you know, that sort of, I think my dad remembered that, we ended up being offered like a hand-me-down Commodore 64 from our uncle. And my dad said yes and brought it home. And I said, well, how do you use this? And he sort of dumped, you know, the pile of manuals down. And he was like, this is how you use it. And I think I was 9 years old at the time. So, you know, obviously I could read. And he just typed a couple of, you know, quick commands like print. And so I figured out how to make art by poking registers and having sprites turn up and things like that, and kind of got hooked on programming from there.
Now that's very interesting. I think one thing that I need to unravel, like, so I grew up in the generation of like commercials specifically for children, right? And there weren't options to watch television without commercials. And I was thinking the other day with my kids don't watch commercials because we don't have cable. Everything they watch is no commercials. So we were on vacation and we were in a hotel and we had the TV on and like some toy commercial came on and my kid is like, what is that? And I'm like, and I had this epiphany, like you've never seen like advertisements directed for children to force their parents to spend things. So I think it's funny that you saw like this really cool commercial and your immediate response to your parents was, I want one. Like, can I have that? And your parents were just like, oh, I wish there was an option where this thing, these commercials didn't exist.
Yeah, probably. Right? Most likely. I'm very thankful for, that's probably the only time in my life I've ever been thankful for an advertisement though, because I feel like that kind of sparked a beginning for me, right? I'm sure I still would have been interested in the computer when it was brought home, but I think that just making that connection immediately, you know, would have been, it made it much easier for me to recognize, oh, I can do the thing that I like the most on this thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really funny how, like, we decide that we want to do something, and then we just continually slam our head against a wall until we get what we want, right? I remember as a kid, like, getting, like, a remote control car or something, and the response was always, like, no. And then eventually when it happened, I felt like I just won the world, right? does this kind of feed into your interest? I know one of the things that you had some curiosity with in your career is like IoT stuff, right? So like, you know, this idea of like, I need to know how it works. I need to take it apart. I need to put it back together. Like, are all these things kind of, you know, do you feel like the origin of all these kind of things that you were interested in started there?
Yeah, I think so. I think all of my hobbies were actually like that. Even if it wasn't like computer related. Sorry, there are some amazing seagulls that do tours of my building, and it's seagull hour right now, so I'm trying not to
Nice.
look out the window. But yeah, so most of my hobbies were actually like that. So I got really into origami and modular origami, and so seeing how, like lots of different individually folded parts actually can come together to, create these kind of dodecahedrons and stuff. And then I was really into knitting, and like knitting is kind of compared to programming because of the Jacquard loom and the origins of computing from there, punch cards, and just everything that I was interested in. Usually, like, sure, it was art or it was creative, but it had some form of like pieces coming together to make a whole, or just like either programming inspired things or just tinkering and understanding how everyday things come together, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it totally does. I think, it's funny how I've had these conversations for a while now, and every conversation either starts off with my parents showed up with a Commodore 64, and I did like yeah, and I did like I did programming through the mail and all that sort of stuff. And then like there's the other people that were introduced to do it to a way later. Like they found it like,
Yeah, toast.
they didn't have access to technology in at home, so they got it in school or university, and it was like this epiphany, like all this stuff exists for me, sort of thing. I mean, so I'm guessing then when you got into school and you started to, I have a feeling that you pretty much were like, I want to get into computers, or I want to be affiliated with computers in my life. Was that fair to say?
Yeah, I should caveat that, like, the Commodore 64 was a hand-me-down, right? So it was the 90s by the time I got it. Most people were on at least Windows 3.1, probably coming close to Windows 95 at that point, just to kind of put it in perspective. And so there was no internet at home, and I didn't have internet at home until only a couple of years before I moved out. And so when I went to school, we had Macintosh computers, and we had things like KidPix Studio and Where in the World Is Carmen Sandiego and things like that, as games, and like Encyclopedia Britannica on CD-ROM and stuff like that. So that was the era of computing for me. And coming to school was kind of cool because I could see like the future, compared to my computers. And so, to be honest, our computer setup in at least my elementary school was brand new. And so none of the teachers really knew what to do with computer lab class, and they didn't allow you to use the labs at lunchtime or anything. So it was really just like half an hour a week or something, and it wasn't particularly stimulating. And same with high school, actually. I did like a short graphic design course where we used like a very archaic version of Illustrator, but you couldn't really go in the labs at lunchtime, which was disappointing. So I think that most of my stuff is really just coming home and just plugging away at stuff as I learned. I think once I got a computer, maybe it was Windows 95 or Windows XP, I think once it was just good enough to be able to do certain things, that was when I picked up HTML and CSS and Flash and Macromedia Director and things like that. And that's where I really sort of kicked off a lot of like wanting to actually work with computers, once I graduated from high school.
Did you do the whole thing, like HTML and CSS and JavaScript? I think is kind of like the gateway drug for most people to get into tech, right? Because it's like immediate satisfaction. Like you make a couple of keystrokes, and then all of a sudden, like you have some horrible like marquee across the page and things like that. Especially like when I first started getting developing in the late 90s and early 2000s, like there was no concept of like good design. It seems like, right? Everything was just get it out there.
Yeah, it was
And that,
awesome. You had your own roles.
And then that equated to like when MySpace like allowed you to like update like your profile pages, so people would just put up just like the worst looking profile pages ever just because it was something to do, right? I always think about that a lot. I think about that a lot. I just think about now, like how just the concept of like allowing users to completely customize like their presence online is. I guess it'd be mildly terrifying. Like most social media, it's pretty bracketed in what you can, customize, I say.
Yeah, I think even just for cross-site scripting purposes, it's terrifying for companies as well. So, but yeah, it's funny that you mentioned MySpace and customizing it because I taught at community college for a while, and I taught like I guess the base level qualification that you can earn in Australia, because that's where I grew up, and it's called a certificate. So I think it was the certificate two. And it was a certificate two, I think, in interactive media or web design or something. And so I just thought, what is kind of the gateway, not the gateway drug, but you know, like what is the thing that I can get people hooked on that is personal to them, that isn't just like, let's make a web page about a sports team. And so I just said, hey, you know, who's got a MySpace profile? And like basically almost everyone put their hands up because it was very popular at the time. And I was like, cool. Have you ever played around with the layout or anything? And they're just like, well, you can't. And I was like, all right, let's do this. You know, and so that was kind of the just teaching the very, very basics of CSS, kind of got them hooked. And I was like, okay, well, MySpace is made up of HTML, so let's learn that. And so that was an outrageously popular class because people got ownership over their stuff, and they got to, their assignment was actually something that they got to invest in and keep for themselves, which is cool.
Yeah, I remember in university, I was a TA for like the entry level computers, like the entry level computer science class, one of them, which was like a web design course. Not
Nice.
web design, but like web development.
Yeah, that's what
And
they called it back then. So.
yeah, and I remember like starting, and I was like, okay, raise your hand if you've ever like done anything with computers, and like it's 50-50, right? But like I was blown away, like how quickly these concepts are picked up by people, right?
Yes.
Like, and this is, 15 years ago. So like obviously CSS and JavaScript has gone light years since then. But it was like, oh, it's just simple as these are the things that you can control, these are things you can control. And I think to your point about empowering people to like feel like they're doing something that provides like positive reinforcement of their like, which is completely different than, I don't know, if you went through like a proper computer science curriculum before or after you learned HTML first, but like the practical computer science curriculum is like you're gonna fail constantly, right? Like you're gonna write code that has so many bugs in it that it's not gonna be an enjoyable experience for you. But once your program builds and maybe the UI does what it wants or maybe the console does what it wants, like that's when you get like that feeling of joy. Right,
Yeah, you
which
get
is
that rush.
two completely separate paradigms, right? Like one involves way more work, but the reward is probably a bit more powerful, and the other one is like, well, I guess like little micro doses of happiness, right?
I think you make a good point. I think that, you know, for me, the making your own web page just felt like instant gratification, right? Because it's all, you know, like JavaScript only really existed in terms of bells and whistles on your site at the time, right? Hotscripts.com and all that kind of thing. And so the HTML and the CSS side, because, you know, HTML is just a markup language and CSS is really just, you know, like a definition for styling it, it was instant gratification. There is no compilation, like you said. And HTML is just so incredibly forgiving. You know, you don't even have to close tags off properly, and it can kind of insinuate what, you know, what you implied. And so that's what I think really captured me, especially. And you could do it offline too. Like I said, I didn't have the internet, but I could still make web pages. And so like that's pretty accessible, you know, for people. And because I didn't have the internet, I couldn't download things like a Java compiler or things like that, right? Unless I found it on a CD-ROM on PC World magazine or something. So I was actually pretty limited, actually use compiled language just for that reason for a long time.
Yeah, it's very interesting that like the gates that are put up. I mean, and this probably isn't fair, but we're getting closer and closer to a place where the majority of people have internet access. But that's still that number isn't 100%, right? And I see all this gating around people that just have internet access. Like, we talked about JavaScript, right? Like it used to be like an offline experience, right? But now, like you need to install like 500, megabytes of stuff to get like, to be able to get like a program that actually works if you're using like a JavaScript framework, right? Which I think is interesting. It's all about adding options for people, but I think the more options, obviously, the less accessibility, to your point.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think that your point about more and more people getting the internet these days, you know, it's skewing more on the balance of people don't necessarily have internet like in their homes. It's more that they have internet because they have a cell phone plan, because they need a cell phone plan for other reasons. And so it kind of gets bundled in, and they're looking at things on a tiny little window on their phones, which doesn't have a lot of storage, doesn't have a lot of performance. And, you know, if they're if their cell plan is not, you know, LTE or something, they also have to wait to pull down all that JavaScript that you just talked about. So yeah, it's not the best experience, and it definitely doesn't replicate like probably our early days of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how we live in this world where we have, like, especially in tech, I talk about like communities in tech all the time, about like there's millions and millions of people in these communities, right? And but there's all these sorts of, there's all different groups of people that just don't have access to these communities for a lot of reasons, right? And like, how do we kind of turn that circle into a U, or use whatever like cliche metaphor you want? Like, how do we get more people into the bubble? And it's something that I've been trying, I feel like, a long time, and a lot of people have been trying to figure it out for, and it just, it seems to me like for every like one step we take, like you take a step back because of reasons. Like, I use Twitter as a great example, right? Twitter's like the greatest thing ever. Twitter's also the worst thing ever.
Right? And, yeah.
So I mean, you know, the talking a bit about when you like, you kind of, I feel like you kind of painted yourself into this world of, I love computers, I love technology, and this is what I want to do with them. So when you got out of university, like, kind of, what was your first step? Like, let me find a job as a software engineer and just party from there?
Yeah, so my schooling experience past high school was an interesting one, because when I went to see my careers counselor, you know, who you know, everyone has it at high school and in a lot of schools, they were like, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I really like computers and I like making web pages. And they were just like, I didn't really know if the job in that. And I think that one, it was probably just circumstances around my school, you know, and like socioeconomic things. Also, they didn't know what to do with a girl who liked computers, because I'm pretty sure I was literally the only girl. And so I think threw them off. So they didn't really have anything to recommend me. They sent me some generic kind of info sheets for generic IT degrees. And I looked over them and I was like, I don't want to do any of this stuff. And so I figured, okay, maybe you just can't do school with this. So I ended up actually just like my parents stumbled upon an ad in the newspaper for the equivalent of a community college. It's called TAFE in Australia. It's called Technical and Further Education. So there was a 2-year technical school course that I could do, where I would come out with what's called an advanced diploma, which I think is like an associate's here. So it's a 2-year intensive course, and it was in multimedia, which meant everything from sound production to video to flash animation to writing grants, art grants, so that, you know, you're not actually working for the man and things like that. And so it was more of a generalist course on creative computing. And so I had no idea that computer science even existed. And I wish that I had, because to be honest, as much as I don't regret the associates, I probably would have gone on to do a computer science degree, because they would have been a pathway into that from there. I didn't know computer science was a thing until I think I was 25, 26 years old. And I felt very wounded by that. But at the same time, I didn't know any better when I got out of that associate's degree. So sorry, that was a very long way of saying that.
No,
I didn't really have a traditional path, even though it was semi-traditional, right? I did go and do school for computing. And so I came out, and the school had such great connections, because, you know, it's very hands-on rather than theoretical. Yeah. And so my first few contracts were really just companies that had a good relationship with the school reaching out and saying, hey, we need like a 9-month contract for someone and we don't have a high salary. And so definitely got my foot in the door through that. And then I returned to teach for a little bit too part-time. So I was able to kind of juggle these contracts for a year and a half until I sort of had enough industry experience to really step into some big full-time roles from there.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, what led you, like, what, like, computing is, so it seems like a very, like, I guess, ops, I guess, if you want to use the phrase ops specific degree, right? Is that fair to say? Or ops to practicum? Like, you did a lot of like operation type stuff, or was it, you know, maybe to talk a little bit about like what the actual, like, some of the curriculum was. I'm curious.
For the school that I went to? Yeah. So we had one class in, it was basically like interactive media. So it was learning how to program Flash games, which was really fun. So that was one of the only programming courses that I actually did in that class, in that course. And then there was sound production, where we just learned how to record and produce sounds. I had an entire 2 semesters of 3D modeling and animation, which is incredible, which has helped me so much in my life, way more than I would have expected. Yeah. Then we did like more theoretical things, like we had a copyright class, so that we understood the rights that we had when creating works and then and derivative works and also on our own works. So it was kind of cool to do a 9-week copyright course. And then we had film studies where we actually just studied film. And so it was just so incredibly varied. And then I think that my web design course was learning HTML and CSS, which I already knew. But then we learned Cold Fusion and Microsoft Access as the backend. And so that was very interesting too. So it was just a lot of, it was actually almost like, this is a terrible analogy. It's not quite correct, but it's almost like the gen ed or the liberal arts of like computing course, you know, like you learn a little bit of everything. So you know how to do anything with a computer, which is kind of cool.
No, that's, I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, you know, we're in 2021 now, and like, it seems to me like a lot of the classes that you took were like to be successful, like in this new way of getting, of, you know, reaching out with content.
It was computer literacy.
Like,
definitely.
Yeah. But it's like, it's definitely stood the test of time. It sounds like, I mean, for instance, for me, like I've had to learn like how to do stuff in Photoshop, learn how to do stuff in, you know, Adobe products, I guess, which is not typical for people in computer science backgrounds, right? But like to have like a leg up with like, okay, you know how sound engineering works to some extent. Like these are things that, I mean, I would have loved to take classes like this in university. It's interesting that when I went to school, like I got a business degree. So it was like how to be successful in business / with computers, where it's like, you know, there's web page design classes or like systems design classes. It was very much like set up how to get a job in traditional, like corporate, like back room developer sort of jobs.
Totally.
Right. And obviously, you know, I don't know if that's good or not. Like, it seems like every different program exists, like computer science, at least in my opinion, like they gear you towards a lot of research and academia. Or like, because like a really, a lot of, I guess, problems that have already been solved by major companies. And then like you have these IT degrees or information systems degrees that are like how to get a job in like the IT department. But like, there's not like, I think that there's this additional type of classes like you're talking about that are really helpful, right? Like how to like manage media, like how to, like copyright is something that's very, very interesting in open source, right? Like, so understanding how copyrights work. I mean, I'm envious of your alter path, or an alter is probably not the best word, but like your different path into tech, right?
Yeah, it's almost like in between non-traditional and traditional, if that makes sense. It was, it was the kind of thing that like back in the early days of Apple computing, they would have really valued a course like that. And they would have been trying to hire people from that kind of thing. Because of, I know that they tended to lean more towards wanting to hire artists rather than scientists at the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely have zero regrets doing it because of all the opportunities that came after it, but also just being able to have this grab bag. Like, I feel like, you know, I was a jack of all trades at one point, right? Before I really started specializing once I got into the industry. And so I'm so thankful now that I just feel like, oh, I could just learn how to do this. And it's up to me how good I want to be at it, but I can definitely get the job done. You know, that was a good boost of confidence.
Yeah. I mean, I just keep going back to the fact that it's like, I would have like 15 years ago, literally learning some of these skills would have been very valuable today, which I think, I mean, I can't speak for a lot of folks, but I don't remember jack what of anything.
Yeah, a lot of people said that about computer science, which makes me really sad because you don't quite have the understanding of how it's applied. And so it doesn't feel as rewarding and it feels much more abstract. So it's much harder to remember. And I totally agree with that. And I feel that the perfect blend would have been the 2 years that I did and then a final year of actual like how do computers work, like more computer engineering and algorithms and operating systems. And I feel like that would have been absolutely perfect. I think that that would have set me up really well. And instead I sort of, because I had this sort of very creative route through, I sort of had the blinkers on. I was like, well, I know how to use computers, you know, on this very top level, but I've definitely had gaps that I wish I'd known about so I could fill them earlier in my career. But, you know, like no harm done. We kind of got there in the end. So.
Yeah, I just, it's crazy to me that I mean, and maybe I'm just, you know, beating a dead horse or something like that, or use whatever horrible analogy you want to use. But like, it seems like most jobs out there in tech, like, they're, here's some data, build an app that sits on top of that data, right? And like, when you start to like look at more complex problems, it's like, okay, then you can use some computer science principles. But languages and frameworks have gotten so good that a lot of the algorithms that you need, they're very, you know, business domain specific, right? Like, I can't speak for you, but like, I've never had to write like a bubble sort in my entire life. Like, for work, right? Only like during an interview process has I ever had to write a bubble sort, which I think is kind of interesting. But I think, you know, going back to your kind of progression through your career, I think at one point you've, and this is probably, you know, you can probably elaborate on it. Like, you kind of built this interest in like community and like having conversations with people about things, right? Does this go back to kind of the fact that you were an instructor, or is this kind of after the fact? Like, I kind of want to get to know, like, what made you so interested in like being a part of the open source movement, being interested in developer communities, and obviously some of the advocacy work that you've done.
Yeah, that's a good question. I will say that it's probably not the answer that you'll get from other people, but it might be. So I'm interested in knowing. But I guess, like, so I sort of waded into open source around 2015. But I mean, I think at that point, I was over a decade into my career, right? And I really didn't, I'd never even heard of GitHub until I think I was maybe 5 or 6 years into my career. And so it just really wasn't a thing. I think I was lucky in that, you know, people had already won the battle of open source and free software and you know, all that kind of stuff. So I just took it for granted and didn't really know about that world. And I was a front-end developer for like the first 14 years of my career too. So there's a certain amount of back-end stuff that you can get away with not knowing. But I completely forgot your question. Sorry, can you re-ask?
No, that's totally fine. Community. I think so.
Yeah. How did question, I get into community? Thank you. Community, yes. Okay. So I promise I'm getting there. And so
it's fine
for me. It does actually dovetail really nicely into what we just talked about, where I went through this like kind of non-traditional computing course, right? And when I got out of it, I was like, there's all these computer science people and no one's making art with computers and like, what is going on? And I actually just kind of felt super isolated. And so, you know, I ended up just finding other creative friends. And part of that was through also teaching night classes at the university, just for adults to do casual courses on, you know, Flash animation and web design and stuff. And I made a few friends through just teaching those short courses. There were maybe 9 weeks. And so, you know, if I got along with any of the students, we would stay in contact after they completed the course. And so and they were usually around my age, which was great. So I ended up just kind of hanging out with a bunch of creative people who really loved creative computing. And I realized how beneficial that was for me, because one, you always do better things together. And two, it's just nice to know that you're not the only one, right? Because it got kind of depressing working a job where you're just doing CRUD stuff, or it's just, you know, like things to make money. And so I guess I just wanted that escape and just to find my people. And so from there, like every single thing that I've done to do with community has been around either trying to help others not feel that same way by saying, no, you know, there are other people out there that exist that are interested in, you know, different things. And, you know, this is how wide and breadthful computing can be. It doesn't just have to be working for a tech company, right? And so everything that I've kind of done, including my open source, has just been me actually wanting to just create connections with people. And to sort of like make sure that people don't feel lonely in this industry. And so it's never been a very deliberate approach. It's just been a, oh, I found this person, and so I'm going to talk to them and work with them. Or, oh, we both had this idea, so we'll put it together and put it on GitHub, you know? And so it's been very organic, I guess. It's just, it hasn't been intentional whatsoever.
I mean, no, I loved all of that. I think one of the things that really, that, you know, as you were talking, you used the word lonely, and I immediately was like, yes, yes, right? I mean, in people in tech, like, for the most part, like, it's a very isolated job. Like, sure, you have colleagues, and maybe you're working on the same thing at the same time, or you have a manager, but, like, you're very dependent on having conversations with yourself, like, constantly. And I feel like this probably might be like an anthropological thought too, where it's like we're always looking for that group of community, the 100 to 150 people, and we need that in order to kind of have to feel some form of security.
Yes.
And I'm not saying that everybody needs groups, but for the most part, I think humans in general need groups. So when we look for communities, it's like, okay, what are the people out there? Who are the people out there that have shared interests with me? And then, like you said, people go to GitHub or people go to Twitch or Twitter or other social medias or whatever and find their people. And I think that's great. But at the same time, it's all about leveraging information that already exists to help shape what's next, right? And that's how the relationships are being built. So I think one of the things that I'd love to talk with you about is, obviously, I think you have an opinion on open source and how open source can be really beneficial for folks, but there's all these communities that aren't accessible to everybody. Like, so what are some of the things that you can think of to kind of help that?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that have a lot of opinions, but I want to sort of keep it.
I want to hear every single one of them. That's
No, I just
fine.
want to keep it like super relevant. And I'm just looking up a book actually, so pardon me for typing.
No
I don't
problem.
know whether you've read Working in Public, the
I
making
have
and
not, no.
maintenance of open source software. Yeah, so I feel I promise I'm not plugging my employer. They just happen to be the publisher, but that's obviously how I came to know about the book. So it's called Working in Public, the making and maintenance of open source software. It's by Nadia. I think her name is Egbal. I feel so bad. That's probably a terrible pronunciation. But it is a fantastic book because it is an outside look into open source. And anyone who's even just like cloned down a repo before will relate to a lot of the content in there. And if you're a maintainer, it would be painfully relatable. And that definitely smokes out a lot of the things around what's difficult in getting started, what is difficult in like sustaining. And how your relationship with open source changes depending on how you're interacting with it. And she also names these different kind of grouping strategies and communities around projects, the different types of them, such as, the federations and things like that.
Sure.
Absolutely fascinating read. And I think that for a lot of people who are just entering the industry, they're told, oh, to get a job, you've got to put yourself out there and stand out from other people. So you should have a GitHub and you should
Yeah.
be blogging and things like that. But no one ever really says like you can do those things because they're rewarding and
Yeah.
there's not this motivation. And so when someone creates a GitHub account, they're just like, I don't know what repo to make and I don't know what to create because they're kind of being
Yeah.
forced in a different way to create something. Or they say, I want to contribute to an open source repo, but I don't know what to contribute. And I think
Yeah.
what people don't understand is you almost have to be consuming and then recognizing that something's annoying and you want to shave down a rough edge, to even like want to contribute to a repository, right? It's not just hunting around for typos in README files. And so I think a lot of the trouble that people have with this is just not actually having something that's exciting for them
Yeah.
to pursue in that area more than anything.
Yeah, I mean that's at least I think that's very spot on. Like I think a lot of people get into certain actions because they think it's going to help them succeed in some way. Like you mentioned like the GitHub thing, right? Like there was that trend, I don't know if it's even still a thing, where people were like, "Oh, look at my GitHub contribution chart. Like look at all the green here." And
Yeah,
it's
it's a
like a
competition,
yeah,
yeah.
it's like a badge of honor. And I mean, I got into, tech in general, and I guess the extension of like my job, like the off hours things that I do in tech, because I just realized at some point in time, it's like, well, this is like, there's all this cool stuff out there, and I could probably meet some interesting people. And I had some help along the way, don't get me wrong, but like, it was as simple as like going to certain GitHub repositories and like, is there some docs that I can help write? Or like, something as simple as that. And that's like a great entry for people is like, if you use something, then you probably can help contribute in a bunch of different ways that you weren't even expecting, right? Like issues and pull requests are great contribution mechanisms, but that's not the be all end all, right?
Yeah, exactly. Triaging and helping people out and yeah, documentation writing is equally important and very, I think so. I'm really glad you actually said that it's not just about issues and pull requests because if you read that Working in Public book, they do talk to certain maintainers who just say, most of the time, we don't necessarily need people to be making pull requests and fixing bugs. And probably the highest maintenance thing burden for maintainers is to have lots of one-off pull requests from people who fix the thing and then they get out and they never come back to the community again, which is perfectly acceptable. But then they don't have these regulars who are coming back to like triage the issues and things like that. And so they need more administrative help and like a constant presence from a select number of people more than, oh, we're going to fix everything rapidly and merge this. And, you know, because someone's got to do all of that work. You know, every pull request that gets opened is an ask for a maintainer's time.
Yep.
And so it was really interesting to read that.
I mean, I've said this probably 100 times on this stream, and I apologize to everybody who's heard it a million times, but like the open source projects that I maintain that people actually pay attention to, there's not many of them, but there's some. Like somebody will open up a pull request or they'll ask me like, oh, you know, could you add this feature? And I'm like, oh, I would love if you open up a pull request, but that doesn't mean I'm going to accept it. Because at the end of the day, and I've said this a few times, like you open up a pull request, you come into my space, you do your pull request, and then you leave, you might never come back. And then I got to maintain the code that you wrote that I might not know how it actually works. And, you know, that's a negative, not just to me as somebody who has to maintain this going forward, but to potential users that, you know, things might not work the way they want anymore. And now we're in this position where I have to figure out like how to reverse engineer somebody's thought process on doing things, which isn't fair for anybody. And I'm all for, if you've come across a repo and you feel like you can add some support to it, by all means, like pull requests. But like, I think the pull request and run approach is just kind of, it's sad. I mean, it's not, I don't think, and I shouldn't say it, don't do it, but think about what you're doing and think about, you know, adhering to, you know, contribution guidelines if they exist. Have a conversation with the contributor before you even start to do the pull request, because, you know, there are some repos out there, they don't want pull requests. Like they have, you know, 3.5 pages of contribution guidelines. And if you can't adhere to them, like they'll just decline you immediately. And that's okay, because they want to protect themselves. And I think at the end of the day, that's just fine too.
Yeah, it's definitely a tension. And it's, you know, it's a different compromise for every single person on open source. And I think that's where it can be difficult for people to get started too, because we just talked about a whole ton of nuance that they don't have, right? And they don't know if just saying, I'm not going to merge this and explaining why and closing the issue or closing the pull request, they don't know if the etiquette of that is actually rude or gatekeeping or not.
Sure.
You know, it's really hard because it's a whole different ball game to just having a transaction in a cafe, you know, compared to this, where you're just like, does them closing it mean they hate me? Does it mean that my code's not good? Does it mean that my idea was dumb? And a lot of the time, that's just those three things. That's absolutely not the case, but it can feel like it's aggression as well, or it's just hard to figure out, like, did I do something wrong? And so a lot of people do get really discouraged if that's their first experience. And I empathize with that 100%, because it's just, it's not that they can't sort of move over that. But like, if you don't know what you don't know about the community rules that are unspoken outside of contributor guidelines, it's very difficult.
Yeah, I think it's quite as simple as, you know, if you want to help somebody, be along for the entire process, right? Like you don't go, this is probably a terrible analogy, but you don't like go to like a mechanic and you say like, I know how to change oil. Can I like change this oil in this car and then never come back, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, that's a terrible analogy, but I'm going to use it anyway. I think the long and short of it is, like, everybody in open source, they're all people. They all have all sorts of intricacies with how they handle things. And sometimes, like, it's just not in everybody's best interest to do things that are outside of what people are expecting or want. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason why I love the developer community is because it's a conglomeration of folks that are all very passionate about the tech that they're passionate about, right? You know, to the effect that people get into very heated arguments about, you know, option A versus option B. And I think that's great. As long as we can have these conversations in a healthy way, like there's nothing wrong with that. It's when they become unhealthy or acts are unhealthy is when things start to become discouraging. Not just for the people in the community, but people that might want to join the community. Like, I mean, if I was looking to join some tech community, like, I don't know, Rust, which I don't really know a lot about, but I'm curious about Rust because everybody talks about it. And if I saw the Rust community was very like anti like newcomers, I'd be like, well, why would I want to be a newcomer?
Yeah, it's like
And
that sucks.
not to bang on Rust, but like that's like I don't know anything about Rust, so I don't know if the community is great or not. I assume it's great because people
I've heard
talk about how
great
great
things about
Rust is.
them. But yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's just like an example for people to think about. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Honestly, these days, well, so it's funny that we're on, a coffee and open source podcast because people who aren't familiar with my work are going to go and look at my GitHub, and there'll be not very much on it this year because I've been taking what is my first break in 6 years of open source, and also I've been pursuing a college degree in my personal time, which just basically robs most of my open source time. And the things that I work on are generally kind of mostly they've been kind of done and stable for a while, so they don't need a lot of tending to, thankfully. But if you go from 2005 to 2015, where I have, I think, 1,000, and in 2016 I have like over 1,000, like little green boxes and commits and stuff, and you just sort of see it gradually fall off. I think that what I try to do now when I do dip into open source is just think about what you just said, where I'm not just, even if I am going in with a change, I will choose to only make that change if it's not some little bespoke thing just for my edge case, if that makes sense. And so, the last pull request I did, I believe, was like on Go Releaser. I think we use Go Releaser at work for it to release our CLI tool, and I added, I think, post-install script support for Scoop repos, which is like a Windows install. Oh, you would know that.
It's a package manager, of
Yes.
sorts.
So, Windows Package Manager. And so we wanted to do a post-install script, and I was like, I cannot be the only one who wants a post-install script for Windows. And so I added that because I felt that other people would absolutely make use of that. But if I had some like little nuanced thing about our CLI, release process, we would probably just patch that or come up with our own custom script for it, right? And so it's making that call where, it's like, is the burden, it's what you're talking about, is the burden to impact ratio balanced enough where I'm
Exactly
not
that.
actually destroying more and more of this person's time? So, and the maintainer of Go Release is just fantastically, very jovial, just wonderfully encouraging person. So ended up being a really great experience, even though I was doing that open source work on the clock officially. So
Yeah, I mean, and think that isn't that kind of the dream anyway? Like to be able to do all the things that you want and get paid for it, right? I think that's
it's pretty
kind of
good.
like, it's kind of like the dream. And I know that some people have gotten to that point and other people are striving to get there. I think one thing that you mentioned that I thought was really interesting is like, you mentioned a couple of things that I would kind of categorize as like self-care, right? You said like taking a bit of a break, continuing education, like things that you're doing for you. Right, that are and I think that that's great. Like I think a lot of people in general get burned out of tech because they feel like they constantly have to be shipping stuff, right? Whether it's blog posts or tweets or work or whatever, or open some open source project, but we don't ever take a step back and it's like, is this actually bringing me joy? Like not to quote like a TV show that's on Netflix, but like does this thing bring me joy, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. It does.
And it I've had enough of these conversations to realize that there's a bit of a balance, especially as you get, I guess, prominent, probably isn't fair to say, but you get a little bit more well known in tech community. It's like, where's this person been? Like, what are they doing? Well, and the answer is like, it's none of your business. But also, it's like, I had this conversation with tech influencers occasionally where it's like, do you ever feel like you have to, you can turn it off? And the answer is like, I mean, yes, but at the end of the day, like if I turn it off, people ask me where I am. So like you're never actually off, right? And I think well, that's one of the interesting things. And I wanted to kind of finish the conversation talking about, some of the work that you've done in developer advocacy, the developer tool stuff that you're doing at Stripe. It's like, not shipping code like as a day job, but like being like really deeply entrenched with communities and figuring out like how they can best take advantage of things, right? At the same time, like empowering them to contribute if they want to. Like, you want to talk a little bit about that? I know that was a really loaded thing, but
No, that was a great question. And I promise I was kind of, there's these two bald eagles that are so ex- anyway, sorry, I really
I
love
mean
birds, and this is the worst spot for me to sit for a
no like I
podcast.
mean no not totally fair. Like
It's so beautiful.
I took my ADHD medicine like an hour and a half ago, so I'm just looking at stuff at my desk like, oh, that's not where it's supposed to be. So I totally get it. I totally get it.
That's awesome. But yeah, I heard every word you said. So yeah, we can totally talk about that. So I did actually, so I did DevRel at Microsoft, just for
Sure.
those who weren't aware of my career. And then I made the move into developer relations at Stripe. I was in that, on that team for the first 7 months, but then, to be honest, I always had the intention of moving back into engineering, but I sort of wanted to still have that community aspect. So I was trying to find a good balance. And so a very lucky opportunity arose, 7 months later, and I actually moved into the what's called the developer products team. And so now I actually work on the developer tools that sit in front of, like, our users of our API and the API itself. So instead of just doing curl commands to our API, we're sort of responsible for a lot of the things that sit in between that make your life 100 times easier. So, a VS Code extension, the Stripe CLI, and the client libraries, the SDKs, and they're all open source, right? And
Yep.
so by moving into that team, not only am I already skilled in open source, which means, professional communication in a public platform, understanding pull requests and how to respond to people, triaging, making those trade-offs we just talked about. I had all of that experience, and I was able to come over and apply that to the work that my team does. And so that was a really exciting transition for me. And so I've retained that community aspect, but I've gotten my, I guess I've scratched the itch of wanting to work on, I guess, very long-term, deep technical problems at the same
Sure.
time,
Yeah.
which there are definitely rare places in DevRel where you can do that, but it tends to be arguing for a specific feature or bug fix, or making a demo and then moving on. There's
Yeah.
not a ton of long-term work in DevRel, and that's what I missed. And so I feel very fortunate to be in this balance right now, where I'm solving super tough problems, and some of them are proprietary and behind closed doors because fintech company. But I get a lot of time as well to work on open source and even just help other people on my team who don't have experience in it learn how to actually do that for themselves too.
Yeah, I mean, tons of really useful info there. One thing that I think it's, I mean, for folks who don't know Stripe, yeah, it is a financial services company, right? It's fintech, right? Like, but at the same time, like, we're talking about things that are like, you can have some of, like, even though you work at a company that is in the quote unquote, like, not safe for the public space, right? You, like, there's still, like, lots of stuff you can do in the public that are awesome. Like,
Yeah, and the company's been really good about giving us the freedom to do that too, so that we can remain connected to our community in a better way.
yeah, and because I think one of the things that's very interesting, especially about a company like Stripe, is that like it is a platform, right? Like they have like an end product that like our suite of end products and that are around financial services, but like they also have all these different products that service developers too, right? So for people to extend that
Exactly.
platform. So like
Yes.
the idea that's like, okay, like we're this group inside this larger company who want to make sure that other people can use this platform that aren't just people that are using like the end. Like it's funny because you have like multiple layers of customers, right? Like
Totally, yeah.
you have customer who is just swiping their credit card, right? And then you have person that's building some API so their thing can integrate with your payment system, right?
Totally.
It's kind of brilliant that you know these companies exist that have these different, I guess, modes of operation. Right, instead of just the typical like, here, go to our place and deposit your money and do these things, right? Like it's just very interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of allowed us to kind of segment the work that we do pretty cleanly
Yeah.
so that we don't have to find a good middle ground. We can just say, okay, we have our developer audience. They're highly technical. They were our first audience for the company, right? Because it was the famous 7 lines of code.
Yep.
But then we now actually support business owners that aren't technical, and they can run a lot of their business just within the Stripe dashboard, right? And then, yeah, like you said, we have our customers that are entering their payment details into, the hosted checkout options that we provide. And so we want to make sure it's a good experience for them too, right? And so we have a lot of different customer types,
Yeah.
but because we can split our product offerings to cater to specific audiences in that way, it's actually really refreshing. And it just means that, yeah, because I work on just products for developers only, it's great to be able to really own that and do it really well, because we're not having to kind of dilute the experience to support other people, if that makes sense, because they have
No,
their own stuff.
it totally does. I think, I'm curious, and if you can't or won't divulge, that's totally fine. I respect that. Like, what is the thing that when you first joined, you were like, oh, I did not know this thing even existed? Like, it can be a tech thing or a paradigm or how Stripe approaches different personas being different types of customers. Like, what was the thing that was like very enlightening for you right when you joined there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Now I'm going to have to really think. There's plenty of things that I would be able to publicly talk about. They just wouldn't be maybe as exciting. But I think, I mean, the first one that I can touch on quickly is just the fact that you can actually say that you're going to put users first and mean it, and formalize that into and institutionalize it, where it means that there are less games, because unless you can say this is going to have an impact on the user and not my next promotion season, and not, not like squeezing money out of these people in a bad way, and taking advantage of users, it's very refreshing, because I feel that I can do my best work as a result, because I have a very strong anchor to be able to tie all of my work back to and remind people if they, wander off the tracks. Because at the end of the day, it's a business that we're trying to make money too, right? But that's something that I find really refreshing. But with technology as well, we pride ourselves on internal tools for ourselves as well, and that makes us productive. And so we don't treat each other like second-class citizens either, which I really, really, really love too. And so I can go the extra mile if we're trying to make it easier for other teams to add a feature to the CLI, right? And things like that. We can actually spend time road mapping that out and saying, how can we make it easier? Because, if internal teams can make our CLI better, then we should be trying to pave the way for them to make that happen. And so I think that those kinds of just elevating certain experiences for the right people so that you can get good work done has definitely been a huge part for me that has stood out about the company. And that does actually, it does actually involve a lot of technical work to make that happen really smoothly.
That's fascinating. Like, I mean, I've worked at tech companies that, most of the innovation, like the craziest things you ever think of, are done and nobody ever sees them, right? Like how,
That's
like
exactly right.
you've worked in tech for long enough to know it's like probably the most like eloquent solutions are like ones that's like, oh, we're trying to like do this one thing to make this one thing work better, and nobody will ever see it, but it's like, it's a backbone of something. Like,
Exactly.
that's really, really interesting because you can't really brag about, like, it's funny because we were talking about like the GitHub, contribution things. And it's like, that's kind of like a braggadocious thing. But like, there's all these things that we do in work that I bet a lot of people would be very excited about if you could talk about them, right?
Yes,
And
that's why I
it's,
had to be so careful, but
yeah,
yeah, no,
sure.
exactly.
Yeah. To your point, like even though you're shipping tools for developers, like there are services or processes that's like developers don't need and to are and we don't want developers to know about this for plenty of reasons. And that's cool because it's all about making developers' lives easier. And if you add complexity, more than likely you're adding, challenges for people to onboard using your tools.
Yeah, we're very sensitive to signals such as, is this implementation leakage? And things go through incredibly rigorous technical review through multiple layers and multiple stages as well, before we're happy with something going out. And so, you know that perfect is the enemy of, is that
Innovation.
what the saying is? And so, we obviously try and keep that in check, but I do know that we just have a higher bar on things, and I like that. It means that sometimes we will invest in something that's maybe technically more expensive, but like worth it in the long run. And so it's more of a long-term, look on things, which I appreciate a lot too. So.
It's like all this is very fascinating because we went this for this conversation talking about open source and things being in the open, and now we've kind of transitioned to like, well, everything doesn't need to be open. And I'd like to kind of get your, I kind of like to get your thoughts as like, we didn't even talk all about like all the interesting things that you do like in the hardware and IoT space. And I feel like we're discounting all this great thing, all these great things that you've done. But I think one of the things that I've enjoyed following you for a while is like you're very open about everything, right? Like you like and no, and I, and that's great, right? I think I really appreciate the people that they're not just a personality, right? And I think one of the things that I'd love to know more is like how do you like to be fair, like you're fairly well known. Like how do you stay grounded? Like when people are expecting you to have some sort of influence or have some sort of like opinion on anything that you have interest in.
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a huge letdown of an answer, which we can talk about, which is
No,
just
no.
I never got into this stuff because I wanted to be well known and I wanted clout and I wanted, money. Not that I make any money off open source at
Sure.
all. It cost me a lot of money, actually, just in buying parts and hosting things. But anyway, I didn't get into any of this stuff because I wanted to be famous or had any of these kinds of power grabs, I guess, anything to do with power or leverage or things that can sort of corrupt and create abusive situations. And I know that like some people can go in without the intentions and they can gain that and then they can kind of, start experiencing those negative things that you said and start actually being a negative person. So I know people aren't immune to it just because of their initial intentions. But for me, I don't know. It's just never been really a thing for me because, to be honest, that whole thing started makes me feel uncomfortable. And this year, I have taken a huge step back. I don't live stream anymore, and I'm not on Twitter as much anymore. And so I'm experimenting with a new balance where, to be honest, like I think that my impact, the impact that I was having, wasn't large enough for the compromises that I was making. And people started assuming that I was of a certain personality. And so it's
Sure.
exactly like you said. I think it's so common that sometimes even I've met people at Stripe and we've started working together. And one particular person said, "I just cannot believe how down to earth you are for a famous person." And first, someone
Oh
calling me famous was like really cringeworthy for me. But also, I just sort of thought, well, what did that person expect me to be like? And so I think there is an archetype that we sort of assume of people. And that made me really sad because I was like, I just kind of inherit that reputation, even though I've never really expressed it. And so that is partially why I've stepped back, because I think that that does make you put things into perspective, especially for someone who is struggling with that and is maybe
yeah.
just not being the best person as a result.
Yeah, I mean, I would never. I tried very, very carefully to not call you famous. So,
I
but I think
appreciate it. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's one of those things. It's, it's the more you're out there, the more likelihood of people knowing who you are, right? And I think the one
Yeah,
of your
it's
things
pretty
about,
accidental.
well, I would hope so. I mean, I don't think anybody. Well, that's probably not fair. I know there's. The majority of people that I feel that are genuine and they're actually enjoyable to talk to, like they didn't get into it for the lulls, right? Like they didn't get into it just for like I'm trying to, find some alternative satisfaction because I'm not getting enough satisfaction in my life, right? Which I
Yeah, and
think is really important.
I actually am really glad you said that because I do want to say that, obviously I was in a very privileged position to not have to do those things for
Yeah.
those kinds of reasons because I already had a solid paying job. I'd already got my foot in the door in the industry and I already had friends and didn't necessarily feel lonely and already had a community. And so things accidentally blew up because of the authenticity of it,
Yeah.
which you touched on, and being genuine and being open because I don't know how else to be. And so I think that that was definitely what drew people in, but then I felt that like the aura of that was just impacting on
Yeah.
distracting from the things I was actually doing.
I think you miss one really important thing, right? Like cool shit. Like if you build cool
Yeah.
shit, like
Yeah,
people
people will find you.
tend Yeah, people tend to find you. And that's always something that's been very interesting to me. It's like, okay, so like where's the cool stuff out there and who's building it? 'Cause that's the people that I want to like those are my new follows, right? Like
Totally.
because they're thinking about interesting things that I haven't thought about 'cause that's how you really grow as a person is like you get outside perspective and it helps shape
100%.
who you are, whether that's good,
Totally
bad or
agree.
indifferent. So we're about end of, we're out of time. And Suze, I want to thank you so much for hopping on. This has been a lovely chat. I really appreciated it. When we end these streams, I like to ask my guest if you can think of open source community, tech community, any of those things, if you could think about it in one word, what would that word be to you?
Potential.
Potential.
I think we have way more potential than we have. And, we haven't figured out a lot of social things to be able to get out of each other's way. And we haven't figured out how to balance commercial pursuits with human improvement pursuits. So I think we have a ton of potential, and I just think we're yet to see it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think as we become more civilized as a species, I think we'll hopefully get there. And I hope maybe I'm around then, probably not, but I think all we can do is do better,
Yeah, you
right? And
just
that's, I
gotta push
think,
on it every day.
yeah. So that's, and thank you so much for that. I think that's a great parting word. So thank you again for tuning in today. Thank you to Suze for hopping on and chatting with us about all sorts of things. For everybody who doesn't know, it's NoopCat on Twitter, NoopKat. I'll make sure that the show notes has all of Suze's info if you're not already following her, which I can't imagine you wouldn't be if you're here, but that's a whole different thing. So, for everybody, enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you again, Suze, and take care, everybody.